Despite widespread drought in the West, wildfires have burned less than half of the 10-year average so far this summer. U.S. Forest Service Chief Tom Tidwell says largely this has been a matter of luck, with the hot, windy weather, known as red flag days, not lining up with the lightning strikes that start fires, particularly in California. But he said that is changing. 18 large fires are burning here in the Northwest, with intensities that are not normally seen until August. The Carlton Complex fire in north central Washington has consumed 300,000 acres. But imagine for a moment a fire 10 times that large, and you'll have some sense of the 1910 Devil's Broom Blaze. It roared across 3 million acres in less than 2 days in Washington, Idaho, and Montana, an area the size of Connecticut burned. It's the largest fire in U.S. history. New York Times columnist and author Tim Egan examined that 1910 fire in his book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. He told us that until the Devil's Broom Fire, there was no policy of fighting wildfires.
They were afraid of wildfire. They didn't know anything about it. It was, you know, the last thing to be removed from the West. Wolves and bison and native people had all been shoved aside, and fire was this sort of mysterious thing that was destroying cities, including Seattle and San Francisco and Denver. And so this decision in 1910 was made, they actually thought, you know, Spokane was going to burn. So the decision was made to mobilize people from all over the country, mostly immigrants, but soldiers as well. There were African-American Buffalo soldiers and forest rangers who commanded criminals and other people, to mobilize people, and for the first time in our history, to try to fight a wildfire.
And I understand the government enacted martial law. This was an all-out effort.
Yeah, because things were really chaotic. I've been on a lot of fires right now, and you see some of the panic every now and then when one of these things blows up, which is what happened. And that's one of the similarities between then and now. We still have these awful blow-ups. But back then, they declared martial law, and at the point of a bayonet, you know, they were basically telling men to get off the train. The only train going out of town was for women and children only.
What was the reaction of the populace to these strong measures that the federal government took?
Well, I mean, the public was skeptical. I mean, they didn't think, especially in Idaho, there was some racism. I mean, there were these African-American soldiers, these Buffalo soldiers who fought this fire, and they didn't think much of them. They didn't think much of these immigrants who had been called in to control these fires. And they didn't think much of the federal government's ability to control it. But the feds made a sort of pact. They said, you know, give us a chance. We think we can beat fire. It was really awful. They lost 100 people in the Big Burn, which was, you know, actually small compared to the size of the fire. But five towns burned to the ground. Four of those towns left the map. So they never reappeared. Well, if you go today and walk the scars on the land that are left from that big fire, you don't even see the footings of where the saloons were and the villages. Those towns burned to the ground and disappeared. They are no longer there. So people did die, in some cases horrific deaths of who were left behind. Others were forced at the point of martial law in the biggest town in the fire, that was Wallace, Idaho, to simply defend the town. And they had this sort of bucket brigade. They held hoses. They got up on roofs. They wheeled their shovels and their axes, and they were able to draw a line after the fire had burned about three-quarters of the town to the ground.
We're talking to Tim Egan, New York Times columnist. He's also the author of a book about the 1910 fire, The Big Burn. How did that 1910 fire change the way the government looks at wildfires?
Yeah, you see a lot of echoes of 1910 in 2014 all across the West, but right now in our state with these fires. The main thing was thereafter they vowed to fight every fire. So you had a lot of fuel buildup, and you still have a lot of fuel buildup all over the West. Fire is part of nature. Fire is part of these national forests. It needs to come through, and they tried to fight every fire for almost a century, so you had a lot of fuel buildup. The other thing was the organizational change, and you see its logical extension now in the militarization of these firefights. The Forest Service, which was set up as a conservation arm of the great dream of Teddy Roosevelt, became, as they themselves called it, the fire service. And now more than 50% of their budget is in trying to control wildfire. A third thing is people were against the national forests as they were formed back then. Now they're loved to death. And 22 million people live within a half mile of a national forest. And most of the effort, the money, the agony, and the pain that goes into firefighting right now is trying to save people whose residences are right up against these public land areas.
Are there methods and tools of fighting fires today that we take away from that big fire in 1910?
Yeah, the one thing that hasn't changed, Ross, is we still send men and women up. Well, they didn't send women then, but we do now, to dig a fire line. That's the oldest and most elemental way of trying to stop a fire, which is to build, take an axe or a hoe or a Pulaski, which was invented in 1910, which is a combination of axe and hoe, and scrape away the earth and cut down the trees so that when the fire and the brush, so that when the fire comes up to this line, it will stop. We also did backburning back then, and they do this right now. You can see in some of the images coming out of the Carlton Complex fire that they're doing backburning. The difference is they have aerial assaults. Well, they'll dump fire retardants and water on large sections. They didn't have that then. But the two main things are still the same. Just send people up to the fire line and try to draw it, draw a circle around it.
The Carlton Complex fire is only a tenth of the size of this big fire back in 1910, but are there similarities between the wildfires we see today and that giant one?
Yeah, and the eerie thing, Ross, that I was struck by in reading about the Carlton fire, the weather system for that year was almost identical to this year. That is, we had a wet spring, so there was tons of growth, vigorous growth of grass and fuel. In a largely arid area, the Carlton Complex fire is in a pretty dry zone, probably averages less than 15 inches of rain a year. And then just as in this year, a switch went off, like early May, and it never rained. We haven't got any rain for almost 3 months. That's exactly what happened in 1910. So tons of fuel, ready for the burn, and then everything dried. And then a third eerie coincidence, the big burn was started by a series of lightning fires, and the Carlton Complex fires were started by lightning as well.
Is a 3-million-acre wildfire even possible today in 2014?
Well, if you had anything on that scale today, remember, an area the size of Connecticut, you would have a mobilization of probably 500,000 people because so many structures are now in those places.
Tim, why do people still live in fire-prone areas? We've heard terrifying stories of people having to flee their homes, and yet people stay.
Yeah, the main thing is because these are pretty areas. People like to live, you know, close to nature. They like to live with open views. They like to live with public land at their doorstep that has no restrictions. All these things are attractive to people. Despite all the efforts of government agencies to say you need to create a defensible space, you need to not have a roof that could catch fire, you need to clear 100 yards around your house, even the insurance industry, which is one of the drivers in this area because they won't insure people who live in fire country, has not held back the tide of people who want to live in these pretty, they're not even isolated anymore. I mean, you can get everything your urban needs are in the nearby town. So there's been this huge influx of people who want to, who live in fire country. And that's really what's changed from 100 years ago.
That's Tim Egan, the Seattle-based New York Times columnist and author, telling us about his book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America.